Today on Speaking Out of Place, I talk with award-winning novelist Leila Lalami about her new novel, The Dream Hotel. What happens when the state, with the pretext of protecting public safety, can detain indefinitely certain individuals whose dreams seem to indicate they may be capable of committing a crime. Set in a precarious world where sleep-enhancing devices and algorithms provide the tools and formula for making one's unconscious a witness to one's possible waking life, this novel touches on a myriad of political, philosophical, and moral concerns as they particularly connect with issues of gender, race, ethnicity, privacy, and the security state. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Welcome. I'm really honored to have you here to talk about this wonderful new novel. I want to start by asking you to do two things, actually. First, could you give just a brief synopsis of the novel, its key elements, maybe sketch out a plot line or two? And then you mentioned that you started writing this novel in 2014 and then set it aside for a while. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened in the interval that led you to take it up again and how the events that transpired during that interval might have affected the original content and perhaps the form? It seems so eerily prescient is what I'm getting at. But anyway, please. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It really is such a pleasure to see you and to be in conversation with you. So The Dream Hotel follows a Sara Hussein, who is a museum archivist and busy mom of two, who on her return from a conference abroad is detained at LAX because agents from the Risk Assessment Administration have determined that she is at risk of committing a crime. And they've come to this conclusion based on an algorithm that has analyzed a number of things, including her dreams, and detected her intention of harming her husband. And so for his safety, she must be confined in this facility known as a retention center for a period of 21 days. So she is transferred to this facility, but she is not released at the end of the 21 days is the only spoiler alert that I can give. And it's on the first page. You find this out that she has been there a while. And then one day, a new resident arrives in this facility and basically disrupts the order of it and sends Sara on this collision course with the companies that have put her there and precipitates her search for freedom. With respect to the second question, I did have the idea back in 2014. I had overslept one morning, and the first thing I did was I reached for my phone to check the time because I was in a panic. And I saw a notification from Google that said, if you leave right now, you will make it to Yoga Works at 7:28. And I was just so disturbed by that because I had not told Google what day of the week, what time of day, or even that I went to yoga. It wasn't on my calendar or anything. But because the company followed my movements, it had learned that generally on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I was in my yoga class by 7:30 in the morning. And it had quite helpfully reminded me that it was, you know, I was running late. It was time. I should have already left the house by now. And I was just so disturbed by that. It was one of those moments where you get a glimpse behind this curtain of surveillance and how granular it is, this information that the companies have gathered about us. And I turned to my husband and I said, pretty soon, the only privacy any of us are going to have is going to be in our dreams. And then I thought, but wait, what if someday with enough technological advances, this data collection can penetrate dreams? What might happen then? And because I'm an insomniac, remember that I had overslept. The reason I had overslept was because I fall asleep quite easily, but then around 2 or 3 in the morning, I wake up and I cannot go back to sleep until pretty much 6. And so I thought, oh, I know how I can make this premise a reality. I can invent through fiction a device that is a sleep aid, and it's going to fix my problem because it's going to actually help me sleep. And I would sign up to get a device that would help me sleep. Of course, the cost of that is that data would be collected from this device. And then that way I can get this premise started. So I got to work on this idea, and I imagined this character in a tech company in Silicon Valley. And I started writing and learning more about how this device came about, the kind of the workings of the tech company, what it hoped to do with it. But after about maybe 60 or 70 pages, I hit a wall. And I think it's because the tone, the voice wasn't quite right, the character wasn't quite right, and the setting of a tech company just felt to me very sterile. I just didn't enjoy being in a tech company. I had worked actually at a tech company before I published my first book, so I was familiar with that culture, and I didn't care to spend several years back in that world. And so I set it aside, and I started working on another novel that I had an idea for, and that was The Other Americans, and that got published in 2019. And I was actually packing my bags, getting ready to tour the paperback when we went into lockdown in March 2020. And so that's when I thought back to this manuscript that I had set aside. And I thought, maybe now is finally the time to look at it again, because I noticed right away how much our dependence on technology had grown during the COVID era. It seemed to me as if we had crossed the Rubicon. Like, it was just everybody. Like, I never used food delivery apps, for example. I never did that. I never used grocery apps. Like, everything was mediated by technology. People were having, do you remember people were having cocktail hours on Zoom? Yeah. Everything that is pleasurable about our lives, everything that is annoying about our lives, everything about our lives was mediated by technology. And so I felt that, okay, now I'm actually in a state where I can imagine this novel and be able to work on it. And so then I picked it up again and worked on it until it got published, getting published now.
that's a great response. And I have to tell our listeners that, of course, we met when you came to Stanford in the middle of Silicon Valley.
Yes.
You gave a great reading of The Moore's Account.
That's
which
right.
is another fabulous novel. And the last time we saw each other, I think you were here doing some other gig. Yeah. I think our relationship is somehow colored by the environment. Dream Hotel, yes. So static and almost claustrophobic. And
yes.
Response to my question really seals that in a very interesting way. You mentioned several texts that you drew on for inspiration. You took bits and pieces. So could you talk a little bit about that and how you fabricated something utterly unique out of these things?
Yeah. Should I just start riffing on some of the titles and you can stop me if I've gone too long?
No, whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. So I should say at the beginning, as you say, first of all, is this challenge of setting this novel in the retention center. So I was looking for ways to work with that and to really enhance the interior life of my main character, Sarah Hussein, because it is a book that hinges on whether her dreams suggest that she is a criminal. I wanted to work with dreams. And so I started thinking through dreams, their place in our culture, the kinds of dream collections that are available, because people have collected their dreams throughout history. There's a sultan, for example, in Mysore, who wrote down his dreams and found inspiration in his dreams for some of his military and strategic battles. So I just started to look at different collections of dreams. And one of the first ones that I came across was The Third Reich of Dreams by Charlotte Behat, which I should mention that this title is now, it was out of print when I came across it, but is now actually getting reissued by Princeton University Press. And so this book is, as the title suggests, a collection of dreams from the Nazi era. And the author was living in Berlin and was noticing just anecdotally through her conversations with friends that their dreams were essentially nightmares and were like warnings about Hitler's rise to power and what might happen. And she started writing down these dreams and smuggling them out of the country. And when she herself left Germany in 1939, she then collected these dreams in a book and wrote like her interpretation of what she thought about these dreams. Like I remember one of them, for example, during the era when people were obviously starting to report on one another, this person dreamt that all of the walls of their house were made of glass. So it just suggests like this fear of being exposed by outside forces. It's a really interesting book to read. And one of the things that came out of reading that book is I thought I have to include my character's dreams in this book because it hinges on that. Yeah. But how do I do that in a way that feels dramatically interesting? Because that's one of the first rules of it's one of the rules of creative writing. You can't really put dreams in it. You can't say that it was all a dream. It's one of those things that many writers are warned against. And I wanted to forge ahead and do it anyway and find a way to make it interesting. So that book was a nice inspiration for that. Let me see what other titles. I did quite a bit of reading on basically what I would call literature of incarceration, basically memoirs by people who had been put in prisons. For example, the memoir by Asata Shakur, Guantanamo Diary, just different books by memoirs by people who had been imprisoned. I read fairly extensively from Foucault because for Discipline and Punish, but also really his work on Madness and Civilization, where he writes about places like asylums and sanatoriums where people who were deemed quote unquote insane were confined. I just find these spaces to be frightening, but also dramatically very interesting. And then a lot of novels that hinge on dreams, for example, Ursula Le Guin's The Lathe of Heaven, where one character's dreams actually become reality. And what happens when that power falls into the hands of his psychoanalyst. Yeah. So just a variety of books that were by my side during the time it took me to write this book.
One of the other issues that you and I have talked a lot about is Palestine. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think that a lot of the novel gestures toward that. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah. So one of the things that the novel does, so when you open it and you find out that Sarah had been in this institution for longer than the 21 days that she had been told she would be in, essentially gestures towards indefinite detention. And one of the inspirations, and I mean by inspiration legally, like the legal apparatus that I had to imagine in the book in order to make this work, was administrative detention in Israel, whereby Palestinian prisoners are held without charge, and that detention can be renewed every 6 months. And so people end up staying in prison for several years without having charges against them, which means they never actually are tried. They're basically just caged. And I was also thinking about places like Guantanamo Bay. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking about the system of island prisons that Australia runs. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why the title is The Hotel is because Australia was also putting refugees in hotels. So that what I was thinking of when I was imagining this. But one of the issues in writing fiction is that if I had made it exactly like that, it would have been almost too much, because it would be too real. So I almost had to dial it down and make it the 21 days and then it gets renewed and renewed. In fiction, you achieve plausibility, ironically, by actually turning the dial down, way down on reality, because you want to give the illusion that it's real, but not that it's real. And what's really strange about it is that just by giving people the illusion that something is real, you actually achieve that level of terror that you're going for, rather than the other one, which means you would not necessarily bring in readers to that world because it would be too close to what is happening in our world.
The premise is that what triggers all this, pun not intended, is a mass shooting.
Yeah.
And the first thought that I had was, so they're going to set up this horrible regime instead of enacting gun control, right?
Yes.
So again, this automatic way of triggering this as opposed to changing a horrible situation in terms of the availability of arms. Yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, I would sooner believe that the United States would establish a system like this of essentially a crime risk score for individuals modeled on FICO scores for money than that it would agree to gun control. Just because the gun lobby is just so powerful. Like, I actually think that it would be, it's easier for me to imagine like this crime risk score that, of course, would be decided by some private contractor using taxpayer money than it is to imagine this gun control finally happening. But having to have saying this does not mean that I don't think that we can get there. It just is a critique of it. And
No, absolutely. Because the way that the gun lobby couches it is that it's the free market. It's their freedom cannot be eroded, so you have to give up yours.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's the formula that we face over and over again across different terrains.
Yeah. And it's exactly what you say. It's like these free market solutions. It's these capitalistic solutions. And they're not solutions because they tend towards extraction of resources, and they are the opposite of nurturing people or taking care of people.
Yeah. And it feeds off fear. You have to have a constant production of fear and person's sense of their incapacity to deal with fear. So you rely on institutions or weapons or prisons to create that. So you mentioned earlier that one of the main challenges was finding a voice for Sarah. And the voice that emerges is so marvelously crafted in that it's both incredibly strong, but then begins to be eaten away at by doubt. And this is, I've tried many times to formulate this question because it's, for me, the center of the novel or my reading of the novel. So I'll try to approximate some sort of coherent question, which is one of the very powerful elements of the story is the gradual and steady growth of self-doubt. That doubt is not just produced by the imposition of the interpretations and readings of the security state. And I use that as a shorthand because the state shows up in all sorts of very subtle ways. But also a doubt that's produced within as one begins to doubt one's own motives, morality, ethics, and at base one's own judgment of oneself. And you do that so well and so hauntingly. And I'm even thinking this idea shows up in the title of the book, which is Dream Hotel. And is it really a hotel? And what's this environment that she's in? I guess my question is this. Humans have always had doubts, but how does your book make a very powerful statement about what I would call a crisis of judgment today? What's happened in our society today where this has become stronger than ever? Maybe it's technological, maybe it's political, maybe it's a combination of all sorts of things. But could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question and so well observed. So thank you for that. I think where I was going with that is the effect of surveillance, the self, is to me a source of the doubt that all of us feel. When you live in a system of control, whether it's technological control or state control or academic control or social control, every system of control is going to depend on like surveillance and on when there are infractions, quote unquote infractions, when they are caught by the surveillance systems, the consequences that flow from that. And because people feel that they are surveilled, they start disciplining themselves. And then when you live long enough under that system, I believe you start to doubt yourself. You start to be unsure of what's right or what's wrong. Did I really do that because I believe it? Or did I really do that because I just have to follow the rules so that I am not caught by this surveillance system? Yeah. And when you do that long enough, doubt starts to grow. And I have seen it on so many levels, but I'll give you the example that comes immediately to mind. And we can talk about other examples as well. But when you think about patriarchal control and how it teaches women and girls, but particularly starting at a young age, to have judgments about their body. So this body is big and this one is short and this one is this and this skin is perfect and this skin is imperfect. And it is so relentless that you see it with young women who are absolutely stunningly gorgeous, and they sit there and they're having doubts about how they look and they're having doubts about their appearance because the system is continually rendering judgment, continually. And because it's just so powerful that people start to disconnect from the part of themselves that renders their own instinctual judgments of what's right or what's wrong or what is even, and doubt grows. And I really believe that that sort of consequence of surveillance can be extended to other forms of control, not just, obviously I used the patriarchal one, but I think it's true of other systems of control as well.
Yeah, as you said, the initial indictment of Sarah is that her dreams indicate she might harm her husband. Right. And P.S. I told my wife that premise and she arched her eyebrow. We can't show that on the podcast. But this notion that what this regime does is it clamps down on one's ability to entertain being human.
Yes, yes.
Because everybody has the capacity to think multiple things. And one of the first things, I'm sure you do this with your students too, that I try to tell my students is that everybody is filled with contradictory impulses. And to think you have to be one thing, especially at universities like Stanford, that there has to be a right answer, there has to be a right feeling, there has to be a right reaction, let alone stuff like political correctness. But mm-hmm. in general, this mm-hmm. notion that to be safe in the world, you have to be secure and anchored in a way. And that makes people incredibly brittle and they break at some point. Mm-hmm. Right. So to live under this notion that you're called to act a certain way, and if you have a glimmer of a thought other than that, then you become criminalized, right? And you criminalize yourself in that way.
Yeah. So and can I just say something about this, what you just brought up? Mm-hmm. Like with students, you sometimes see you're lecturing or talking or discussing a book, and you can see sometimes when you ask questions, you can see them trying to read your face mm-hmm. and to guess at the right answer as if there is only one answer that is correct. And I continually have to break that habit, say, you don't have to agree. I'm not fishing.
It's just
a question. You can think whatever you like. But yes, that comes from having grown up in a system that has rewarded and punished mm-hmm. them. It's very strict. Everything you do is recorded. Your attendance, every assignment is graded. Even their reading is, everything is with quizzes, everything. There's such a high level of surveillance and punishment that there is not as much freedom to just explore the work that you're talking about and have thoughts about it that don't conform to the thoughts of your professor.
And it's such
a challenge for us as educators, I think.
Yeah, in general, but then in particular, this notion of how AI is being applied to monitoring people's responses to things under the guise of we're just collecting data and mm-hmm. it will improve our ability to serve your needs, which mm-hmm. is total malarkey. Mm-hmm. But, and this is something else I wanted to talk about, is the interpretation of data. It's mm-hmm. one thing to collect data, but whose interpretations hold sway? Mm-hmm. And for example, I was talking to somebody that said, we're looking at fly populations. And are they not getting something because their responses are not either correct or they're too delayed in being correct even? And I said, maybe it's not because they're not paying attention, but maybe they're working two jobs. There's another set of reasons for their behavior. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about this notion of interpretation? Whose interpretations hold sway under these kinds of regimes? And your novel has a lot of episodes where one of the caretakers or guards will skew an action, like a simple action, like turning on a light or something, as being one thing or the other. How does the role of interpretation and the double-edgedness of interpretation play a role in your novel?
It plays a huge role.
Yeah.
I think that when you're talking about crime, you're talking about intent, you're talking about interpretation of these actions. And in a court of law, the same action can be made to be a crime or it can be made to not be a crime. So interpretation matters a great deal. And when it comes to things like algorithms, which we're seeing right now, one of the books I should mention earlier when we had talked about different books, there's a book by a professor at UCLA, Sophia Noble. Sophia Umuja Noble, Algorithms of Oppression, right?
She's going to be on the podcast.
That's perfect. It's actually great because that's what her work is all about. Like what these systems present themselves to us as being neutral. And you and I, as people who work with words and literature, know that there is no such thing as neutrality. That in fact, these systems can come with the biases that have been put into that data already. So that's what her whole research is about. When she was Googling for Black girl and the kinds of images that Google was giving her, it was just really frightening, some of the stuff that she found. And those are the things that we know about, right? She essentially stumbled on that and then ended up writing this book. But imagine that at scale, how many other biased images, biased texts, and by bias, meaning, for example, racial bias, but also gender bias, because these large language models, they are not necessarily reflective of the totality of human experience. They are only reflective of whatever archive was put into them, right? So these are all forms of archives, essentially. And so those biases are going to come out in the algorithms. And so I think that one of the things that I was continually trying to get at in the book is how interpretation is dependent on the observer. And whether that's a human observer, for example, the attendants in that retention center see an action. And of course, because they already look at you as a criminal, they're going to interpret it a particular way. But the algorithm itself is not neutral. And when it is fed data that oftentimes is incomplete, that has gaps, that has problems, and it is only making the decision that its makers are expecting it to make, and also is going to provide essentially limited interpretation. So yes, we have this technology, and yes, it's frightening, but what it's doing is it's perpetuating these problems that we already have in our criminal justice system. It's already perpetuating problems that we have with the patriarchal global order, and so on and so forth. It's just that now we're doing it through machines.
And it's also taking away the support systems that we used to rely on, right? And just a couple of things. One is
that
when you think that these AI in universities is building off of algorithms that were started at Netflix and Amazon, and it goes back to your anecdote about Google telling you you have to wake up now to go, it instills a kind of persona in you that's fabricated by preferences that may or may not be yours. Right. That, and it's almost getting back to Foucault, pastoral. It's taking care of you and massaging your life into these forms that may or may not suit you at all, but they're convincing you this is what somebody with your habits and your choices would be doing. So it's an eerie kind of almost zombie like taking over of one's life.
Yeah, it's turning us into lab rats. It's turning us into, for example, the fact that you and I are both on Instagram, for example. And the fact that I see constantly, first of all, I don't see everybody's content that I'm supposed to see. I follow people, but it doesn't necessarily mean I see their content. And then when I do see their content, I see people struggling because they want to have their content seen, but the algorithm is not showing it. And in order for your content to be shown by the algorithm, you have to essentially modify your behavior. I'm told, for example, that things like reels are being seen more than just a static post. So it's like we're modifying our behavior in order to get people to see our content, in order to be able to have these connections with our friends. This is madness.
And connections along a very narrow band of communication.
That too.
But so just to let you know, I've dropped my Instagram accounts. So I'm not ignoring you, Layla. It's rather that I dropped that and Facebook.
Yeah, that's smart.
I do have an Instagram for the podcast because it's not personal, but given Zuckerberg's I'd rather.
No, that's smart.
So talking about support systems, you do have this wonderful move in the course of the novel that as Sarah's time in the facility, hotel, prison detention center, you name it, it's all of the above and more, grows longer and longer, so does a sense of community. And you do a great job of not idealizing that community. I think that would have been a very easy but sloppy move. Each of the characters is fully human. There are some informants. They're not all good folks. But gradually what emerges is they come to find, I won't give away how they do it, they come to find a way toward freedom that has to do with exploiting a weakness in the system. And I believe that weakness is there because the state underestimates the variety of ways that people can resist.
Right? Absolutely.
So could you talk a little bit about how this happens, the way in which we can find power by the lack of imagination that the state has?
Yeah. First of all, I'm a big believer that people have massive power in terms of how much they create. And let me just give an example from Twitter. A couple of months ago, I was reading something and one of the people at Twitter was giving a quote to the press and saying how Twitter had invented the retweet button. And I was like, excuse me, what? I was there when you guys were getting this app off the ground. And I remember that, in fact, it was users, it was ordinary people that used to put RT, retweet, and they would copy paste other people's words because they wanted to say, you need to see this, to their own followers. And when Twitter saw that, it came up with the retweet button. Mm-hmm. The idea came from the user. The company followed. And this happens all the time where users devise, for example, threads, like a thread on Twitter that was users. They would put things like 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. and they, that's because good. They were doing that. And so then the company found ways to create threads. And now there's a whole app called Threads. So users are actually creative. They are the ones who are coming up with ideas. And I think that these big systems that we think of as being over us, because they're so massive, they're not nimble. They're not creative. They're not forced by circumstance, by scarcity of resources, by necessity to be creative. Whereas human beings, because we're all trying to survive, we are going to come up with creative ideas constantly. Clever ideas for how to do things and therefore how to resist. So one of the things that happened through the writing of this book mm-hmm. is that I really stopped being so afraid constantly, although I know that's hard because look around.
Yep, yep.
But I also feel like this great hope because I see that people are never going to run out of ideas for how to resist these systems. Mm-hmm. And what we have to just constantly look for is other people who we are going to be in community with, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that those people are perfect and it doesn't mean they're going to agree with you on everything. And it might be on one issue they agree with you, but then on another issue they don't agree with you. When you're moving forward towards a common cause and you can really make leaps, I really believe that the creative powers of individuals within a community are far bigger mm-hmm. than whatever create. I don't think of technology companies as necessarily being creative, right? Mm-hmm. Like the idea is creative, the initial idea. But then once it becomes corporatized and capitalized, then it ceases to be quite as creative.
Yeah. And again, resisting giving away too much of the novel, which is great, but the solution is very simple. That's what mm-hmm. I love about it. It's not that they devised something complex and extraordinary and so elevated and sophisticated. No, it's just, wow, I never saw this.
Yeah.
You know, it was just the ability to perceive something that was staring them in the face all the time. But here it is. And it's simply, and it's because they've been blinded by the razzle-dazzle of technology and the, mm-hmm. and the supposedly all-powerful
perfect
nature.
Yeah.
And of course, institutions, that's their weakness too. They're arrogant and they can't see the different openings. I have to ask this question. What gives you hope? I know it sounds so trite these days. And in fact, we talk about a lot in our classes. And in one of my pits of despair, I said, hope is too big ticket of an item. I just want to live day to day based on my own principles. So that's the temporary. But what gives you a sense of hope when there's so much doubt and despair? And can we talk a little bit about the power of dreams, right? Because in the novel, the dreams are a vulnerability, but you also show the power of dreams that exist. So maybe attach dreams and hope, any kind of formulation you want.
Yeah, so for the first part of the question, I think that one of the reasons that people feel hopeless is that they are attaching themselves too much to these devices and to the continual stream of horrible news, right? So the word doom scrolling is what we now call it, right? But the effect of doom scrolling, the effect of continually hearing about issues that in some ways feel impossible for you to solve. You, David, and me, Leila, aren't going to individually fix what's wrong with, I don't know, pick one issue that happened today. I don't know, USAID cuts or whatever. Yeah. Hearing about 20 things like that, that as an individual, you can't do anything about is very difficult and very depressing, and it leads to hopelessness. But if you just put down that phone and actually find other people that are in the same community with you and work towards one thing. I make it a habit to just make calls. Like, it's a simple thing, but I feel like if you're going to represent me, I'm going to bother you in Congress. It's the very, it's the bare minimum. So I have them on saved and I just do that all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that you can do as an individual. But your power, when it is added to the powers of others, it just grows. And so finding other people who share the same ideals or the same goals and working with them toward any goal, whether it is helping immigrants, whether it is helping trans youth, whether anything. And then you start to feel, oh, I did this. Oh, I actually moved the needle on this. And then you stop feeling that hopelessness because you actually contributed something. So the problem with social media is it really does magnify hopelessness. And they want you to feel this way because...
Yeah, absolutely.
They have a scorched earth policy with what they want. And so I think deploying your sense of creativity in community with others is, I think, the way to go. And then dreams, I think, are central to all of this. Central. Because I don't think that you can actually achieve anything without dreaming it first. Like, you have to have that vision. Daydreaming is essential to us, right? We spend, although now, of course, that's being disrupted by technology because people are continually hooked. But daydreaming is important. But also the idea of dreaming in the sense of envisioning, like thinking of a future that we dream of that is better. So connecting that dream with action is where it's at, I think. And I can talk more about just the power of dreams in our lives. It's such a fascinating...
Go for it. I don't want to make you work harder than you want to work, but mic's open.
Okay. One of the things that was really a joy in this book was putting in dialogue the sort of world of dreams, which I think of as being completely free and creative, untethered from anybody's judgment and deeply private, right? It is something that only you get to experience. It's probably the only thing in your life that only you get to experience and no one else. It doesn't matter how close you are with your partner or with your children or with your friends. This is your simulation. You're the one who's dreaming it. And I just think that we just don't know enough about the brain to know why we do so much of it, why we spend so many hours every night engaging in these simulations. And the fun part of the book was putting together this completely free, loose world of dreams with the harsh technological, logical, numerical world of algorithms and fusing them into the novel. That was a great deal of fun. And I also, it gave me a lot to think about dreams, whether you believe in premonitions in dreams and things like that.
From a sort of different angle, I was thinking about what gives me hope, which is that, I don't know if it's hope even, but I find myself saying to myself, Trump can do all these things, Trump, Musk, whatever, but they can never have my soul.
Yes.
And by soul, I mean my sense, and we talked offline before we start recording about aging, getting older. And I was thinking, well, I'm not a religious person, but I just want to believe at the end of my life that I would have done more good than not good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the kind of dreaming itself, right? Is imagining a better world that you could actually concretize in small actions, as you said, just calling a friend or calling a senator.
Yeah.
So I think this is something that we both want to hold on to, is that capacity that cannot be diminished no matter how much.
And allow me to say that is a form of resistance, what you just described, because you're not allowing the unelected billionaire and the other guy to take away that pleasure from you. You are doing a lot. I know what issues you're passionate about, and I know what you're doing. And that's great. There's no need to give them more of your time. When you started talking about nature and that you don't want to sacrifice that, it reminded me of the end of Candide by Voltaire, which ends with, you have to cultivate your garden. Il faut cultiver son jardin, right? I think. And as you get older, you start to realize how important it is. You are not going to take this away from me. I'm going to do it. I'm going to enjoy being in nature.
That's a great way to end the show. I had a great time chatting with you. I always do. And again, thank you for carving out time, being on the business time.
But no, anything for you, David.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Take care.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye.